This panel is the first in a series put on by Radfried, Halifax, Chibucto on local queer issues. Today we're going to talk about the queer history of Chibucto, Halifax, and like the end, the second half of the 20th century, and maybe a bit into the beginning of the 21st. Like, we'll see where our conversation goes. These panels will situate us in the city of Chibucto in the region of Mi'kmaq, in the Sibenagadic region of Mi'kmaq, the unsurrendered ancestral territory of Mi'kmaq. Queer and Two-Spirit Mi'kmaq have always existed and will always exist despite the imposition of colonial rule and Western narratives of queer identity. As a settler Canadian, it's not my intention to erase or override these long histories of resistance with a story that begins only a few short decades ago, but to use a relatively short scope to compare things that we see today with things that were seen within the lifetimes of some of the older members of our communities. So Rad Pride is an alternative pride festival which actively opposes the institutions of corporate pride. The name itself, Rad Pride, has a bit of an on-off history in Halifax. I don't know when the first Rad Pride was, and I know we're not going to be the last. But right now, it's more important than ever to remember our roots, remember that the first Pride was a riot, and remember that queer people are still resisting state oppression today all over the world and here. If you want to follow Rad Pride on Instagram, it's Rad Pride Halli, like H-A-L-I. If you want to contact us via email, it's radpride@proton.me, and I think that's our contact info. So, yes, my name is Jack. I am the real Jack. Hello. Now I'd like to introduce our speakers for the evening. First, we have Robert S. Wright. Robert Seymour Wright is a queer African Nova Scotian social worker and sociologist whose 36-year career has spanned the fields of education, child welfare, forensic mental health, trauma, sexual violence, and cultural competence. He is the Director Emeritus of the People's Counseling Clinic, the Acting Executive Director of the African Nova Scotian Justice Institute, and an Assistant Professor of Criminology at St. Mary's University. Robert's identity and work are grounded in his integrated and activist spiritual
work. Robert?
Welcome, Robert. Thank you for coming. Next, we have Vita Jackson. Vita Jackson is all in, and we see that, an omnisexual dance diva, lipstick-wearing activist, building resilience through deviant bank chips, fostering, and humor. For Vita, singing is an act of resistance, community building, and joy, and she has been singing and showing up with the Women Next Door and other choirs, like the Choir with a Q, for over 30 years. She was part of the first ever Rainbow Camp in Canada and has worked extensively with children in foster care and beyond. We have Robin Metcalf. He uses he, him pronouns. Robin is a writer, curator, cultural activist, and community historian of Acadian and Newfoundland ancestry, now living in Sheet Harbour Passage on the Eastern Shore. In half a century of queer activism, mainly in Halifax, Robin has assembled one of Atlantic Canada's largest archives of queer materials. So, welcome, Robin.
Thank you.
Now that these formal introductions are out of the way, I would like to hear a bit more of everybody's stories. The way this evening will work is we'll ask a question of each of the panelists, we'll ask a question and each panelist will have a chance to respond before we move on to the next question. Does that sound good for everybody?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, excellent. So the first thing that I would like to ask is kind of like a deeper introduction. So it's kind of two parts, two ways of asking the same question. So when and how were you active in Halifax's queer community, whether this is as an activist or as an out person on the scene? And what are some of the groups you worked with and the roles you played in the queer and activist scene before the turn of the 21st century?
Who's first?
We can do in the order of introduction, so we can do Robert first, and then Vita, and then Robin, if that works for people.
Sure. Sure. Well, I'll say that I feel a little like an imposter being on the panel, given that I didn't come out until a little later in life. But I would say that I have been fairly active, being with queer people, serving queer people in the mental health and health and human service space. And that goes back to very early days, I suppose, in the mid-90s, when I was the race relations coordinator at the Dartmouth School Board. I was the cross-cultural understanding human rights and race relations. I used to say that I was responsible for all of the isms and obias in the Dartmouth School Board. And certainly that was at a time when queer young people were just beginning to be acknowledged as a presence in the education system and being given opportunities to be supported as queer individuals in the Halifax school system. And I suppose that's one of the areas where I started to become very active in terms of supporting schools in making schools places where diversity was supported, including 2SLGBTQIA plus folks, queer folks. I guess also, if I want to think about before the 21st century, how my work began in the spaces where I worked with vulnerable children, youth, and families. And, of course, we noted that young people who are criminalized, families who are marginalized, that queer families and queer youth are dramatically overrepresented in those spaces. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people understand, that I think when some work was done later on, kind of surveying queer young, homeless young people in Halifax, the stats were showing that, you know, about 50% or more of the young people who were identified as homeless identified as queer. And that's something that...
Water drinking water?
I don't think that any of the... At that time, any of the agencies or services that were providing any help for marginalized folk acknowledged that young people showed... Queer young people showed up like that in those spaces. And of course, it can be tracked back to the fact that queer young people were not feeling safe in their home communities and in their schools or even in their families. And so we're making decisions to be safer from the point of view of, you know, in some cases even safer in terms of their body autonomy. But then to making choices to be safer, putting themselves in risky situations. Right? So I guess that I would say that would be where my work and engagement with the queer folk prior to the 21st century began in the early 90s.
Thank you very much, Robert. Vita, if you'd like to chime in, thank you. I think you're still muted. There we go, thanks.
Although I knew well beforehand, in 1989, I came out, a good friend of mine who was in student politics at Acadia, was coming out, and we've known each other for a long time, and I kept wearing t-shirts like everyone is one and love your brother and sister, like I just kept wearing these t-shirts hoping that she would just tell me. And I was pregnant at the time, and I remember so surreally that we went to Joe's Emporium, and I said I know you're gay.
Like, I don't have the camera on.
Can we just have a conversation about it?
Symposium.
I'm not going to help you. I just I want us to be
pride
okay.
panel thing.
And so we had a conversation.
Robin
and her biggest fear was when I had the baby that I wouldn't allow her to be around my baby. And it was entirely so foreign to me that I would ever be that. And but the fear was so real with her. And I remember
coming up,
if there was a moment around political action.
Yeah.
It really was in 1989, December 6th, when the 14 women were killed at Polytechnic. And we quickly scroll sawed living, life size, purple women that we set all over campus.
Now you gotta give them
with their names and just to show through visual.
Also, it turns
this idea around gender violence. Now, I grew up
just
in a very
getting into my account, so you should have
challenging childhood. It was all about surviving. So this idea, when I was at university, that you had a political will that you could exercise was entirely foreign. So she taught me so much. Maura Donovan, she's been the root of so many things within the queer community. The youth project, that was her baby. A lot of support through the IWK families, her baby. Lots of changes to the ways in which we access services around getting pregnant. So I count her as one of the heroes in the story. And certainly have tried to live by her example. I have done a lot professionally, personally, to make sure that people who have no voice have a voice and that they are seen. And I know that's like one of those things that are said all the time, but personally, I think storytelling is the most powerful tool to affect change. And I mean that wholeheartedly. I think when I've done diversity confidence training for foster families, which is a mandatory 2-day course, the first person stories that we would have people come in and talk about their experiences as an African Nova Scotian, as an Acadian, as a First Nations person with a disability or have different abilities, and sexual orientation, and now gender is part of that training. It came at a time where that was so needed. I mean, there wasn't a single class that I taught. They had 2 years to do it. And in those 2 years, there was such resistance to doing the second day, which was, I don't know who planned this, but Sunday mornings was when the sexual orientation part happened. And I'm like, well, if you're going to church, this is mandatory. We always had issues. So, I went from that in the 2 years as we're rounding down, we had the most resistance to that particular part of the training. So we'd have these, roomfuls of people who didn't want to be there, who were talking about a subject they really had strong opinions about, to being in those 2-day training where at least half of the participants were from the queer community, either as single persons or persons who were in as a couple were wanting to foster kids. And I could go on, but I think that's a good start. I mean, that was my birth of the revolution, although it was in a very small, contained way that really fostered my desire to be a part of things that were unjust.
Come in by yourself.
And speak up even when I felt my voice was very small. So, thank you.
Thank you for that, Vida. I think maybe it's... I think we often underestimate the things that we do because a lot of the time, I know myself and probably many of the people in this online room feel like, no, this is just, I have to do this. This is just what needs to be done. And it seems small, when you look at it from the inside, but when you look at it from the outside, you can see just how much of an impact these different things, and everybody has their own approach to things, and that's what's really needed.
It's a ripple.
Yeah. All right, Robin, on to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I'll say that I have the advantage on Robert because I was out when I think he was in grade 3, although being Robert, he might have been bumped up to junior high by that point, but I just, turning off my camera, oh, you won't show you, I'm sorry, I wanted to show you the picture of me I use as my camera off picture. It's of me in front of, me talking to a bullhorn in front of the Peace Tower in July of 1975, 50 years and 1 week ago, because it was Canada Day. And I grew up feeling radically other, and I think, you know, there's many ways in which people experience that. In my case, it was coming from a family that, although my roots on both sides are deeply Atlantic Canadian, first of all, my parents married across religious and language lines, and in 1946, my mother's parents, who were Acadian Catholic, I think they may not have been supportive if she'd married a black Catholic, but they would have been less upset than when she married an English-speaking Protestant, because with a black Catholic, their grandkids would end up in heaven. But a white Protestant, no, that's not going to happen. Dan just posted that picture in the comments, so you can see what I looked like a little while ago, a mere 5 decades.
Thank you, Dan.
And we moved all the time as a kid. And I should also say that on my mother's side, being Acadian, which I always identified with, because I'm unlike my siblings who didn't. My sister later in life came to accept that more as something meaningful to her identity, but I did from very early. It was always important to me, and I think it's because when I heard the Métis Two-Spirit Elder Albert MacLeod speak recently at the last year at the history conference in Edmonton, and he talked about being two-spirited and that his strength comes from the female line. And that's what I have felt for a very long time, that my Acadian female line, which is made up of amazing women who survived a genocide and then raised like 15 kids on their own and lived to be 103. That's sort of the kind of life stories there are back there. My long Acadian name, my Robin Amagudit Amari Avili, et cetera, it ends with Suzanne, and that's the one who lived to be 103 after having 15 kids. And she's only one example down that line. So my awareness I will say genocide of the Acadians, which is a contested term, but the more generally used term is ethnic cleansing, which is a phrase I just find repulsive and don't like to use. There's nothing clean about ethnic cleansing. So that's, you know, my awareness of that fundamental injustice was with me early in my life. But my father grew up in a highly politicized working class community of industrial Cape Breton, and which, you know, was one of the sites for the most active proletarian insurrection in Canadian history in the early 20s when my father was a child. And he remembered the Royal Canadian Constabulary jumping over people's fences on their horses and trampling their cabbage patches. And these were people who were starving to death. I realized my brother was born on a William Davis Day, which is the day that the William Davis, who was a worker in industrial Cape Breton, was shot dead by company police 100 years ago in 1925. And my brother's name is almost the same as William Davis, and I called him on his birthday, and we both sort of struck us. I wonder if there's a connection between his naming and the day in which he was born. So, you know, my parents were not as political as their kids ended up being, but because all three, like my siblings, I have a sister and a brother, both older than I, we've all been social justice activists. But my parents were always unconventional. They had a very good family friend who was a member of the Communist Party in the 50s and 60s. And my parents always told us, don't believe everything you read in the paper. You have to think for yourself. You have to make up your own mind. So although queer was part of what made me other growing up. It might have been number 4 or 5 on the list. I was already other because I came from a strange family who talked weirdly and had lots of books and had moved here from somewhere else, but where was it? And what are they? They're French, they're English, they're Catholic, they're Protestant. What are their politics? What's their culture? And they're from away, but they're not from away. They're from here. They're from, but we're here. And then to put queer on top of that, and being a brainy kid who was quite queer, quite identifiably queer, but my queerness manifested first in gender nonconformity. Not that I identified as female, but I would wear my book bag the way the girls wear their book bag, and when I was informed of that, that people say Robin is a girl, the correct response would have been for me to be ashamed and embarrassed and immediately chase away and wear my book bag. And my response was, well, the girl way works better. It's more sensible. And, like, I don't like boys anyway. They're stupid. So why do I want to be like the boys? I was kind of dismayed when I realized that I was sexually attracted, which came later after being firmly identified as a sissy fairy pansy freak. So I had lots of reasons to already have a critical view of the universe. I think the main thing holding me back from coming out, which I did when I was 20, I was living in Edmonton, in 1974, was that, I knew that I couldn't go half measures, that once I was out, I would be out all the way. And I was, I moved back from Edmonton to Halifax to go to art college, which I thought was going to be a very gay, supportive environment. One assumes that about an art college, and boy, was I wrong. It was so macho, and probably almost any other art college in Canada would have been less macho at that time than NASCAD. It was a very macho school. And, painters tend to protest too much about their machismo, and they dominated. But the year after I went to NASCAD, I completed 1 year, I went to work on the railroad, and which was the same year I got really involved in queer politics in Halifax, which is 1975, and the railroad was so queerer, so vastly queerer than art college. And it touches on something that's been important for me, which is that although my family are educated, I grew up in a home with books and with a certain access to class privilege, cultural class privilege. We generally grew up in poor and working class areas, whether rural or urban, going in, as I say, moving almost every year, usually to a different province. And so I grew up with working class people, and I realized when I was 16 and I went on a debating tour and first met people who I thought were my class of people, like privileged people in Ontario who sent their kids to private schools. I actually went to cocktail parties in people's homes and realized that class of people I couldn't stand. And I didn't identify with them at all. And I didn't admire their lives at all. I didn't see them as admirable or happy. So part of my politics has been understanding how class politics are more complex around queer issues than just reflects my own life experience. I guess today, on the railroad, I had a lot more room as a gay man, a lot more room to be queer than I had at NASCAD in 1975. So, I have to try to tell you quickly what groups and roles I was involved in the 25 years from 1975 to 2000. I got involved with the Gay Alliance for Equality, which was a general purpose queer organization in Halifax, later renamed the Gay and Lesbian Alliance, of Nova Scotia. And I represented GAE, for example, at a parliamentary committee in June 1975 on immigration policy. And then a couple of days later flew to Ottawa for that, my first conference, which is the one where Dan has posted a picture. He also posted a cover from The Body Politic there, because I don't know how many people are familiar with The Body Politic. It was a Canada-wide gay liberation journal that started in the early 70s and was publishing for 15 years. And it was important not only as the chief vehicle for communication within the queer community in Halifax in Canada, it was also important internationally. If you were a fairly progressive, politically radical activist in Australia, in the Netherlands, in Argentina, you would read The Body Politic. And it was more than any other periodical, it was the one that that the people who got together at international conferences had read, the means by which I exchanged ideas. And I met members of the body politic in Ottawa in 1975, and I had seen it earlier, too. So I was aware of its existence, but I started writing for the body politic, which was also part of my career as a writer, which is one of the ways the key ways I identify. So I was active in two areas. One was in Halifax, where the Gay Alliance was a real all-purpose gay lesbian organization, and I could talk more later if people want about what made GAE really unique as an organization. But it was, we actually had an amazing organized community here for a 20-year period when the Gay Alliance, GAE, or GALA was around, and the extent to which it was diverse. It was men and women working together, which wasn't that common in that period. It was class diverse, I'd say it was racially diverse. It was, and it was addressing all the issues, because there was nobody, there were no separate organizations to provide this or that. We had to run the Gay Line, which gave people where you'd get information about where to go, or where you'd call because you'd never spoken to another queer person and you thought you might be queer, or, you know, where you might be thinking of killing yourself and you needed to be talked out of it. Those calls all came, or if you just wanted to call and harass a queer person, you got a lot of those calls too. But that was, we operated that. We ran a social club, which was the main social club in Halifax and, in fact, in Atlantic Canada. It was the largest place of its kind. We, which also employed a lot of queer people, we published newsletters, some of which, like, you know, Waves, for example, is partly has grown out of that tradition of the newsletters that were published, by GAE and GALA. And I'm not even naming all the things we did. We wrote briefs to Parliament. We organized demonstrations. We picketed places that were discriminating against gays and lesbians, starting in 1975. So I was involved in all those things during that period. I was on the Civil Rights Committee, where the people organized demonstrations, and I wrote the brief that we sent to the Canadian, to the CRTC, Radio Television Communications Commission, to intervene in the license renewal of CBC Radio, because CBC Radio was refusing to take public service announcements for the Gay Alliance for Equality. And so, yeah, that's, and I think that I was writing for the body politic. I then, I worked for 10 years on the railroad, so I, that also meant I was in touch with people in Montreal in the movement there. And I was going to Toronto quite regularly and very involved with body politic. It was, though I didn't live in Toronto, it was like, I was like a distant member of the, effectively, the body politic collective. But I also started writing internationally for the queer press. So, but, you know, and this period leads up to the early 90s when I went to some international conferences in Europe of ILGA, International Lesbian Gay Association, and I was writing for magazines in Canada, US, United Kingdom, Sweden, and Australia. And I thought that I would make my living as writing as a queer journalist. In fact, I ended up, once I started writing full-time, I found that I was, and I, my first writing I got paid for was writing erotica, writing gay porn for Skin magazines published in the United States, because there was no market, there were no magazines in Canada that were publishing that, so my stories were published in American magazines, but they were identifiably stories that happened in Halifax. People would pick up Goddison Street and say, well, Goddison Street, didn't Goddison Street in New York. Giving an idea how poorly paid that is. Don't let anyone ever tell you you can get rich writing gay pornography, because, I found I was making more money writing about art in Nova Scotia, which is the second least well-paying job you can get as a writer, I think. I guess that, and then I ended up becoming a curator. My writing for both the arts led to, being a curator and later a gallery director, and in that role I've always, there's always been a lot of queer content in my work, but also involvement, engagement with various marginalized voices. So I've done a lot of work with Indigenous artists and curators, and I've always been interested in artists approaching from liminal perspectives, perspectives that are outside of the ordinary or that cross over boundaries that are normally set up. There, I should probably leave it at that for the... Oh, I can say one other thing, which is I came out through feminism, so I have a classic lesbian coming out story. I read Kate Millett, and then she put me on to gay literature that I could read, like Jean Genet, etc. So I did have an early identity as a lesbian trapped in a gay man's body, but sometimes that's the cute stuff.
Excellent, Robin. Thank you so much for that. It's interesting that, I mean, like, I have no qualms in saying, like I said at the beginning, I didn't know what I was really getting into starting this panel, so I'm glad that the three people that I have gotten to speak to all have these very different experiences and all have, like, their own stories to tell. So thank you so much. I guess now that we've got a little bit of a sense of what things look like in Halifax over a like long period of time, I kind of wanted to get into the nitty-gritty of why I've organized this panel, which is like, we need to know our history, but we need to do something with that. So with knowing this little bit of our history and, you know, you all having lived through what you've lived through, I would like to ask, and we'll do in the same order just to keep things simple, which events or which changes that are happening now in society are most reminiscent of things that you have experienced or seen in the past? So in which ways are we returning to things we've seen before?
Well, I guess when I was thinking about this question, I was reflecting a little bit on my own experience and thinking a little bit about the Black queer experience in Nova Scotia. Now, I mean, there have always been Black queers, and I think that that there were, you know, notable individuals from the era that Robin was talking about who were Black individuals who were part of that gay scene at that time. But I would think it would be fair to say, and Robin can correct me if I'm wrong there, but
a gay actor?
Though there were certainly Black folk then who were very active in the queer community, largely Black queer folk went elsewhere to live their Black queer lives. Montreal, Toronto, most notably. I mean, my older brother, who was 15 years my senior, was one of those individuals who, I guess like me, because being Black and queer, there's no space in the imagination for that identity. He married and had children, and before ultimately coming out, and of course, once coming out, he went elsewhere to live his life. Now, I don't mean to say that there weren't the Lauren Izzards of the world, who probably one of the most prominent folks at that time, and the Gloria Bordens and the like. But I would say that queer Black young people are experiencing some of the same challenges with coming out and being integrated within their Black community as queer white people were having, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, right? That's where we are, that there is this growing critical mass of young queer Black folk who, it's not new that there are Black queer folk, but perhaps, yes, of course, Walter Borden. Thanks, Robin. Gloria's brother. but these are folk who want to live their Black queer lives here and be part of their community here. And that, I think, is a challenge. I think that back when the AIDS Nova Scotia was recognizing that they had poor uptake in services from the black community in the 90s, they reached out to I'm not sure if it was Lorne who they first reached out to, but eventually Kim Bernard was hired to do a queer black outreach project in HIV, you know, HIV prevention and awareness.
Oh, we lost Lorne. We lost Robert.
That mean everybody did?
Yep. We can't hear him. No one can hear him. Oh, maybe.
But the church kind of has a hold on the black community, and historically always had. And of course, the black churches, whether it's AME, African Orthodox, or Baptist, we often think of Baptist churches as the black church, but African Methodist, Episcopal, and Black and African Orthodox existed in prominent black communities in Nova Scotia, but the thing that they had in common is that none of them were affirming. And so the black church and the black community really did not, it was not cool to be black and queer. And so I think queer young people are beginning to assert themselves as not just members of the queer community, but members of the black community as well. And when we think that the Black Lives Matter movement, which we would say arguably is the modern equivalent to the engine that drove the civil rights movement, you know, five decades ago. When you think in decades, you have to think in decades. And I guess it's a little longer than 5 decades ago. But yes, that the Black Lives Matter movement was founded by black queers, black queer and trans people, and I think that there's a reason for that. I think that. That when the civil rights movement was active, black folk were universally oppressed, and so they were unified in their activities around the black emancipation movement. And now, unlike then, black people have in some ways entered the mainstream. There's now a growing black middle class. There are black folk who live comfortable lives. And so who's going to champion the black emancipation movement now? Who are the black folk who have something to lose? Who are the black people who are feeling outside? Well, it's the black queer folk. And so Black Lives Matter comes out of that black queer marginal experience. I don't think that should be a surprise to us. So we see these black queer young people who are now leaders of the black emancipation movement, and the church is actually the body that's being marginalized. Because if the church can't figure out how to be in partnership and allied with these black queer leaders, it's the church that's going to be left in the dust now. So I think that when I think about what's happening now that's reminiscent of then is that how the movements are moving, I guess. And when I think of the queer black folk and what is happening there, I see this energy, I see this movement, and I see the resistance. I just want to, or the pushback to it from some elements of the black community. Vaya, I just want to point out that you talked about the work with foster parents and foster parents kind of thinking about these things. It's interesting that in the last few years, I've been approached by child welfare organizations, the Department of Opportunities and Social Development. Department of Opportunities and Social Development, the former Department of Community Service, invited me to provide training for black cohorts of foster families, to help them to better understand how to serve the needs of black children and youth and families that they're caring for. And so Teo Ferguson and I from the Youth Project trained three different cohorts of groups of families, foster families. So, again, I'm talking perhaps too much. Where is the motivation for black families to be foster parents? The black families that are foster parents are often quite families that are quite churched. And these families are being asked to look after children of all races, many of these children who are queer, because the fact that queer young people are overrepresented among those children who are abused, neglected, and marginalized. And so, so we were providing that training, and one of the things I was certainly alive to, was that in order to provide that training, we had to answer the black church question. Right? And that it seems to be, it sounds almost quaint or to say that today, but I think the queer movement, the queer liberation movement, had to answer that question. And as Robin suggested, we live in a province where, in his parents' time, the major thing that he said made him other was that his parents married across religions, and so religion is still something that was at that time very deeply embedded in the political and the social imagination of people, as it is in the black community still to this day. So, just stop there.
Thank you very much, Robert. I think this, flows nicely into, I'm sorry, do you pronounce your name Vida or Vida? I never asked you at the beginning.
Vida.
Vida, okay. So I'm sure you have a response to that as well as an answer to what is happening now that is reminding you of things that have happened in the past.
I'm so super glad that there were three cohorts that were trained. Because I was a child protection worker, I saw in the 26 years I was there, foster homes go from 1,400 in Nova Scotia to 700. And that retention was impacted by a number of things. But the expectation that all foster homes could accommodate the diversity that is within Nova Scotia. And unfortunately, we didn't have enough families from the black community, from the Acadian, or from the First Nations communities. So there's been some work done on that, I feel, long overdue and slow, but there has been. Because, and you know, it's funny, the church stuff that comes into play. Because in the beginning, when I was doing the training, you know, a lot of people wanted to foster because it was a service to others. It was wanting to give back to community. And when challenged on, well, you don't really get to pick who comes to your house. You know, you can't have the perfect child who has perfect needs that you can support. They're individuals, they're child-centered, and they're as much and more deserving of a loving, caring home. That, you know, those expectations were challenged, and I feel like that particular training, two-day training, was very instrumental on people deciding, you know, why is it that I'm fostering? Is it for myself, or is it for kiddos? What role do I have? What expectation is there on me? What responsibility to provide a safe, loving home, and what that looks like? And church comes into play. We see that now when I'm doing training around the immigrant population. And I know our household was an emergency safe house. So for people in the youth group who were kicked out of their homes when they came out, we were that emergency home where they could be and land until things were sorted out, because we were a safe and loving home, and we understood the challenges and the high likelihood that suicide was going to be a part of the picture. So I felt very, I felt very privileged to be a part of that process. And, you know, I had a partner of 26 years who we had very similar priorities around family, around supporting the community. But I have to say, you know, when we speak about where are we at now, I feel like every step that we had as myself individually and us as a couple and us as a family, I mean, we lived in Hansport, which is a town of 1,200 people, 5 churches and a dry legion up till 20 years ago. You know, it is a microcosm of what you would expect from a community that wouldn't necessarily be welcoming. I mean, we skewed the statistics just by being us. You know, we lived on a very affluent street. We set up a trampoline in our front lawn, which was probably not expected. And after supper, we would all be, you know, jumping on this trampoline, saying hi to all our neighbors. And when we moved in, there was a no to same-sex marriage on the neighbor's lawn. So I think by fiercely dedicated to creating space for people to challenge us, but us to challenge them, to be as boring and neutral as any other heterosexual family in that community. And we're talking community that had 35 single parent households. So it was kind of like this little pocket, and myself and my previous partner, Marge, would look at each other going, well, have we worked up our deviant bank chips enough to challenge how the school works, how the community works, how the sports teams work, how the extracurricular work, you know, how we are in the community. And frankly, the biggest indicator of us making some inroads is that we were invited to the Washer Toss tournament. Now, this is a town-wide tournament that select few are invited to. And I looked at Marge and I said, we better not win this. Right? Because we were pretty good at Washer Toss. So I'm like, we can't win this. You know, our deviant bank chips will be compromised. And, you know, as community members, we, you know, did costuming in the local plays. We volunteered. We coached sports teams. We just inserted ourselves wherever we could to create an opportunity for people to see us as community members. And that sounds like a small feat, but I can guarantee that that entire community, when it comes to when they see something that is directed towards the queer community and, you know, singling out people in that community to be devalued, to be less than, that they're the first persons to speak up and say, no, that is not how I live my life. That is not what I'm showing my kids. That is not how I'm going to be. And personally, I think it didn't seem powerful at the time, but I have seen through conversations later that that small courage of living our lives in public, in full view of the community, has made a difference with individuals, the children that we were a part of that have grown up to feel like there was a life that they could have all they wanted.
Oh, God help me.
Based on the people who have responded to us. And I think, I don't feel like a hero, but I feel like living our lives.
I hope that didn't go on my recording.
So visibly, and let's be clear, I was a child protection worker in a small community. There were things in my world that targeted myself, my family, my property, my well-being, my safety, that wouldn't necessarily have been a part if I lived in the city. Now, having said that, I don't know a different way to be other than myself. So when I talk about singing being really a protest, is because through our singing, I mean, we supported Pandora, which was, when we were looking for information when I was coming out, it was very few and far between. The movies were so depressing, I would watch them and realize that either the main character would die by suicide, or that their life and ways of loving were so devalued that they lost everything. And I thought to myself, Jesus, if this is my benchmark for how I can fully live my life, just kill me now, you know. And so I made it a point to search out for information. So Pandora, Debbie Mathers was instrumental on keeping that library of positive role models, positive literature, positive connections with community. We used to do she-bops as the women next door, and those were generational things where we would do women-centered dances that we would start at 7, and we would go up by the 60s, 70s, to the 80s, to the 90s, to the 2000s, and we would encourage and invite all people of all ages to come and celebrate who they were in a safe space. And all the money that we created would be given back to the community, either through the youth project. We were part of the first rainbow camp in the country through support through the IWK. So this was a camp that if you were sons and daughters of people who were queer, you could go to speak openly about your family, have 2 weeks where it just, that stress was taken out of the picture. And I'm sure for people from diverse communities like First Nations or Black communities, if they had a space where they could go and they could just be free to be who they were without apologizing, without having to explain, without having to justify their place in the community, that's a good thing. I mean, Waves, Robin had talked about Waves. I mean, that was a key resource to know what's going on in the community. But I have to say, in Yarmouth, my hometown, when I went, and I usually pick up Waves to do the foster family diversity stuff, I found it in the porn section. You know, and I spoke about that at the Yarmouth sessions. And I said, you know, this is where, if you were a queer youth, you find information to protect your health, protect your mental and physical health, connect with community. And I said, and it's in the porn section. And not only that, it was in the top level of the porn section. So you can't be short and access that without asking someone to get it down for you. So, I mean, we've come a long way, but I feel like we've lost along the way this importance of community at the grassroots. You know, I feel like I may not have been the most academic or the most political, but I feel like through the sheer expanse and breadth of how I live my life, that I've created this ripple effect, you know, this continuum of people who have gotten behind valuing people in the community, not just who they look like, but people who have different opinions, people who have looked differently, people who love differently, but not really. We don't love differently. We just love, you know, and to have those kind of conversations. And, you know, I feel like that's a powerful message. And as I'm getting older, I feel like I'm kind of old. You know, I've seen so many changes within the community. I mean, my eldest, Adrian, when we were at his grad, he looked, he said, "Mom, Mom." And he said, "Look over." There was two women in white tuxedos in a convertible. And he's looking at me knowing that when he was growing up, that wasn't part of the picture. And the idea that he would point that out and know that this was like a testament to how we live our lives. I felt very good about that. You know, our youngest, when I think of the changes that people do within structures, within policies, within institutions, I feel kind of enamored with the people who were behind the scenes doing the work to create an easier path for the rest of us. So when Marge and I were trying to get pregnant, her sperm count was low. She told her brother that she started wearing boxers so that her sperm count would get higher. And he took a minute and he was like, ah, I get it. But to add that dose of humor to all the things that people take for granted was a part of how we lived our life. So when I came to wanting to get pregnant, it took 6 years. And 6 years of disappointment and hope and lots of money. You know, in that time, we went from going and myself only being part of the conversation, Marge not being invited, to getting random sperm that I had to take off-site to try to inseminate in a bathroom somewhere close, because there's a 30-minute viability to getting pregnant, to at the end of it, you know, going in and getting to choose a little bit of, you know, the sperm donor's background, being able to personally do it in-house, yourselves just doing the insemination, having alone time, whatever time you needed. And the price had gone astronomically high around that. You know, it started at $135. It was astronomically high in that time. We interviewed six potential donors to create this new life that we wanted. And five of them, we just out of hand just said no because they wanted to be a parent. And there was no laws at that time that protected that journey. You know, we finally did find a known donor, and that's how I got pregnant. But Gabe was the first known donor in the valley. It took 3-4 months extra to have that process, which, you know, it's nail biting during that time where you're like, it's all going to be taken away from me. And what happened was, in the 6 year time, Sue McKay and her partner Nancy challenged the Supreme Court around who could be identified on the birth certificate as the parents. So literally in the first little bit, I would send Mother's Day cards to Sue and Nancy thanking them for the privilege of having to put Marge and I as the birth parents on that. Because up until, I think, the 5 years into it, I would have to give up my birth status for Marge to have any right to our child. You know, so I am a big proponent of thanking the people who came before us, who paved the road to be easier. And I find now there is this privilege, 5-1, and I wouldn't change it for the world, but this privilege has added to this sense of lackadaisical approach to, well, that's my right. Well, it's not your right. It's only your right because we worked hard for it. It could be taken away from you the next day. Like when I see things that are happening in the States, and not just the States, when I see things that are happening around the trans community, in particular here in New Brunswick, in Canada, I think it takes nothing but your silence to make sure that that change is reversed. And I don't have the answers for that. Perhaps people who are in the academic or political sphere would know better ways to do it. I just know through my own way of living that at every possible moment that I have in my life, day to day, I challenge those things. And I bring it to the forefront to talk about it. I mean, even within my own group, we talk about trans rights because it's not something that has been part of the picture. You know, historically, I went to the Michigan Women's Festival where when I went and said that I had a son, I was called a breeder and told that they have no space for my son at that venue. And I understood to a certain extent why that was. But the mother bear part of me was like, fuck you. My job is to raise this son to be as informed and as political and as open to people living their lives to the best of their ability in loving and mindful ways. And so within the community, there's some work to be done around education. There's some work to be done around how we value one person over another. And I think, I'm sure I digressed, but I apologize. I think that there's so much in that space that needs work, and I feel like we've come complicit in how we haven't spoken up or how we haven't organized to create a space where we have a powerful voice. And to be honest, I'm terrified about that. You know, we can talk these states. I don't care. You know, that's the states. They have their own journey to do. I feel like it's trickled into our own backyard. And I want us to fiercely and mindfully and continually rail against that. And I'm not sure how to do it. I just know that I do my best to fearlessly love in the ways that I love. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Ida. As you were speaking, I was thinking about the things that Robert had said about how the Black Lives Matter movement is championed by queer Black people, and how there's people who have gotten comfortable, queer people have gotten comfortable, and there are lots of queer people who are still in a great deal of danger, and if we forget that we're all part of the same struggle, then we're each going to leave each other behind. So thank you for that very much. Robin, just going to read our question again. Here we go. Which events or changes that are happening now are most reminiscent of things that have happened in the past?
Well, thank you. And I'm aware that this, I'm glad that this is the first of the Rad Pride lectures, because in fact, queer and trans history is a vast, vast territory. And we've already touched on enough things to talk about for 12 sessions easily. But I wanted to reply briefly to Robert, just on the, what the situation was for Black queer people and trans people in the 70s and 80s. And I mean, I'm speaking as a white man, so I'm open to, to correction. But, when Robert said that a lot of people went elsewhere, well, that was true for a lot of white queer people too, that, people went to Toronto or Montreal, or even if they're living here, they wouldn't really party unless they went to Montreal, because in Montreal you can party, and if your parents went in Kentville, won't hear about it. I think that the biggest the problem was that people who were politically conscious around being Black, that it was hard to find a space for that, to articulate that within queer space. There were lots of Black folk, sometimes in important positions in the Gay Alliance for Equality and in the institutions it ran. But it's like Robert used to say to me years ago that he was too busy being Black to be queer. And I think that it was because of the reasons he's talked about. There was no way of that queer Black folks, I think, had a way in the 70s, let's say, or 80s, of exercising collective queer power in Black spaces or collective Black power in queer spaces. So they'd have to choose which community they were being part of in any given moment. And so it meant that although there were lots of Black faces in queer spaces in Halifax as staff, as customers, as people performing on stage, in drag shows, etc. GAE wasn't called on racism or on the, you know, the white, presumptive white kind of ways of thinking of the world that prevailed, because those black folks, I guess, would not have felt the collective sense of empowerment to do that and assert themselves. So it's a vast political change in recent times, in terms of, like, when he's talking about Black Lives Matter, and it's wonderful to see that that's changed so radically in the general culture, that there is a queer black, you know, space that is as black as it is queer and as queer as it is black, which has impacts for the black community and for the queer communities. But I wanted to talk about, try to address specifically the question about what we've seen before, and I can say that, I mean, one of the things that was important for my generation coming out was finding out about the German movement. When I was writing for The Body Politic, The Body Politic was published by Pink Triangle Press, and Pink Triangle Press was named for the pink triangle that homosexual prisoners wore in the concentration camps during the Third Reich. We became aware that the most advanced country in the world up until 1933 for queers, for gays, lesbians, bisexuals, for trans people very much, was Germany. And there was a 40-year period of progress won by collective action in Germany. And it was wiped off the face of the earth by the Nazis. And we weren't learning about that from anybody else. We only learned about that by being part of a queer movement that began to publish books and articles and to inform one another about what had happened. We had had such incredible advances, and then we had lost so much. We'd lost a lot of people who were murdered by the Nazis, but we also lost a world that had been created, and we had to create it again after World War II. So we had that awareness, and I think that it's important, like, you know, my sense is that people who are in the black community who are at all politically and historically aware know that it's not a steady line of progress. There's massive, you know, shifts backward. Like, there's the emancipation in the United States, and then there's Reconstruction and the undoing of Reconstruction. There are ways in which black political power was greater in the United States in the 1880s than it was in the 1980s, in terms of elected officials, etc. It's one of the disadvantages of being queer, because we don't generally grow up in queer families. At our grandmother's knee, we don't learn the story of the queer struggles of our ancestors, unless we're lucky enough to have a lesbian grandmother, or a trans grandmother. But we have to educate ourselves about history, and that's why things like this talk are very important, because it's a collective community project that we need to do to make up for that lack that we don't, because we don't grow up with it, as it's not given to us by our families and the institutions we were in as children for the most part. And I think it's been a real shock for a lot of younger people whose only memory, their memories are only of this century, in the last few years, to see how radically and how quickly things can go backwards, and how much at risk everything can be. And while it's horrifying and frightening, terrifying, as Vita says, and disconcerting, is not surprising to me. I have confronted homophobes in public forums at a time when I had no legal rights at all. You know, like, there was no protection that I would not be fired or kicked out of the school or denied, you know, services or kicked out of an apartment, or if I was a parent to have my children taken away from me for being openly gay. I've been in that situation, and with other people in the same situation, and we've stood up to homophobes in public and called them out. So it's in a sense less scary because we've been there, and we were there and we won, which makes a big difference in your the way you frame it. I mean, we went through several phases. There was the, what of things of the past that are like now? Well, in the late 70s, there was Anita Bryant and there was Renaissance International in Canada, a lot of right-wing Christian groups that are part of what's going on now in the United States and in Canada. But they were much more specifically the group that was mobilizing then. And it was a big push backwards against, because, oh my goodness, look at how far things have gone. We've got to stop this. And we stood up to them, and they, you know, they scared us, but they didn't stop our advance. It was contested. You know, Dade County of Florida passed the human rights legislation that protected gay people, and then it rescinded it because of Anita Bryant's movement. But in North America as a whole, more municipalities passed, you know, rights protection than rescinded it. The movement was generally forward. And then there was that, you know, that led into the Reagan and Thatcher period, when there was like with Reagan, it was simply completely ignoring the effect of the AIDS crisis in the queer community, not saying the word AIDS, even though he had friends who were dying of it. In England, there was Clause 22, which was actually criminalizing activities to promote homosexuality. You can see, imagine what that means. It's, you know, teachers talking in a supportive or positive, non-judgmental way. So there was real, you know, right-wing pushback. But I'd say that through that whole period, we kept on winning, and AIDS itself, which was the biggest, where there was the greatest fear, because people were actually talking, you know, about, well, let's tattoo people who are HIV positive. Let's put all the homosexuals on Sober Island, so that they can't infect other people. There were people here who were proposing that. Politicians, people who were elected officials, who were talking about putting, gay people in concentration camps to protect public health. But what happened is that through all those things, I think one of the things that was really important was that was coming out, because that was the most radical, I think, cultural force we had. Because AIDS actually pushed that forward more, because so many people who hadn't been out to their families ended up having to come out to their families because they're HIV positive, or their partner was, while many people suffered horrible rejection because of that, the broader cultural meaning of that was that people realized that they were surrounded by queer people. It also meant that although there were lots of political divisions between gay men and lesbians, less so in Halifax. I mean, we fought like cat and dog, but we worked together in Halifax to a greater extent than in many other places in the 1980s. But when AIDS came along, so many women in the lesbian community and women's community came forward to be support workers and to be politically supported, like to be involved in ACT UP and in demonstrations, etc. Because the issue is so big. Our friends, our brothers, our relatives, you know, were our lovers and former lovers were dying, and it brought the reality of gay life home to a lot of people who weren't in the gay community. And so the AIDS crisis, in the end, advanced our rights. At enormous cost. Again, the loss of a world, because the world that I came out in, the gay world I came out in, it doesn't exist in that form. Since AIDS, and most of the men that I would be spending my old age reminiscing with aren't here. They died 30 years ago. And the power of coming out is one of the important things, and the visibility of the community. And I think we also need to be aware that while it's easy to be very afraid, we are empowered. We do have the advantage, certainly in Nova Scotia, and I think in a lot of Canada. It's less true in some places like Alberta, but even in Alberta, the urban culture is very different than the rural culture, and the political situation, you know, gives power to the rural areas, but in terms of population, they did elect a new democratic government, and I think that the right wing in Alberta is going to find they have a lot more opposition than they realize they do. But I know a couple of, you know, over the last year and a half, when the 1 million march and things like that started happening, and people say, and homophobic forces started asserting themselves in Canada, saying, oh, well, maybe we can do what they're doing in Florida. And what happened is that, like, for example, a speaker came to the Pentecostal church in Muscadon Harbor, which was a mistake that I understand that the minister made. The minister didn't actually know that they were, like, radical homophobes of the truck convoy people, but booked this speaker who came and the congregation came to hear this person, and then, but there were like 70 people inside the church hall, and there were 120 outside on the road on the number 7 highway with placards and banners, and all basically peace and love, just saying, you know, we're your friends, we're your neighbors, and all sorts of businesses in Muscadon Harbor put up pride flags, and because they have quite an active community there, and it's a visible community, and they already have had a pride event there for several years, what they demonstrated was that Muscadon Harbor isn't there. We're not buying into this, and it's interesting that after this event happened, the minister at the Pentecostal church apologized to the community because he said, I didn't realize this is what we were bringing in and it's not what we want to be associated with. But I think it's really important that what we demonstrated was that there was not just that our community, like queer and trans community, but that the community in general, that we, to the extent that we've become visible and integrated into people's lives, this question has been settled in a way. So whether or not you maintain internal homophobic or transphobic feelings, there's also, let's keep social peace. We know what's been settled in Canada, and that's that these things are okay, that they're part of the community. And, I mean, it's amazing, the year that Pride basically disappeared in Halifax for reasons that were much more internal organizational, there were Prides everywhere in Nova Scotia. There were Prides in Truro and Annapolis Royal and Bridgewater and Yarmouth. And I think that's really critical because that our visibility that we demonstrate, we're here, you're part of your community, you know who we are, we shop at your hardware store, we serve you at the food land. People, especially in rural communities, know they have to rely on their neighbors, and if they know who their queer neighbors are, and if their homophobic neighbors haven't been that visible, the homophobic neighbors would probably better keep their mouths shut, because they're not going to be well received. But we have to know we have that power, and we have to exercise it and demonstrate it, to be visible, to be confident, and to be present in the community, and to that we represent social peace and continuity of a kind of peace that's been established, to the extent it's been established in Canada, that we represent that. But I think also in terms of what other things I learned from, one is the importance of knowing our history. That's really, really critical, of finding ways of communicating it and being aware of it. It's important to have organizations that are big tent organizations. A lot of our queer and trans organizations now are much smaller, and they represent specific needs, like we get together because we like to knit, you know, or we represent, you know, young, radical, artsy, trans people. And I know if I were the young, radical, artsy, trans person, I would want to hang out with other people like me. But I wouldn't want to just hang out with people like me. You might, you know, it's important sometimes to hang out with people who may not be like you, who may say things that you have trouble with, and that you need to challenge at times, in a friendly way, in a supportive way. But it's important that we have organizations that aspire to bring together a broad, diverse community, not only a diverse community of queers and trans people, but also we need to build coalitions with other progressive forces. And probably the biggest thing where things have moved backwards, like through that whole period when I said we kept on winning, what we weren't winning is class politics. The working class was losing power through that entire period from the 70s on. And what's also lost its power is there is the collective left, which there isn't a left that has a coherent and compelling narrative or image of the better society we are hoping for. A lot of us know what values we want to have in that society, but we don't have a picture of it, we don't have a map of it, we don't have a manual for how to construct it. And there were lots of things wrong with the old manual. The Marxist manual was flawed, to put it mildly, and some of its effects were certainly disastrous. But we do need to work towards a coherent collective vision that includes economic justice, includes class justice, as well as gender and race and ability, etc. So yeah, and I think, and just one last point, which is that I'm aware that we're in a period. It's really easy to focus on one problem at a time. Like Canada is now, we voted for a prime minister who, I'm glad we voted for the prime minister we did instead of the other potential prime minister. But it's like our focus is now Canadian sovereignty, and I think we do need to focus on Canadian sovereignty in the face of American aggression. But that doesn't mean that the environment is like we can sort of put that aside now, or we can just put aside decolonization now because we really have to focus on this. It's like if we don't come up with solutions that are global, that we imagine a world in which Canada is sovereign and we're less dependent on fossil fuels and where we have more proper justice for Indigenous people, etc., etc. We need to come up, we need to have a vision of that's compelling of an actual world we could live in that would address all those problems. And part of the problem is that electorally, there is no one on the ballot who represents that. You know, I can't say there's a party that's appearing there that has a vision or a program that actually is credible for addressing the issues that need to, that are life and death issues. They're all life and death issues, and they all need to be addressed.
Go ahead, Robert. I see you have your hand up.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say that I agree. It's not hard to agree with just about everything Robin says. That certainly has not been my challenge. But I do want to just kind of to talk a little bit about the need for a big tent organization. I think that as true as that is, we need to recognize that making a big tent organization broad enough to include the diversity of queer folk, particularly those who are on the margins of the queer identity, is the responsibility of those who are in the center. We cannot say, and I know that Robin wasn't meaning to say that, but I don't think that trans, artsy, BIPOC folk should feel the burden of contributing to the big tent organization that is necessary for this next iteration of the queer emancipation movement. It is for those at the center of the movement to broaden the tent to include those folk, right? And I think that that is critical. I think that in my life, I am often invited into spaces to contribute the idea of diversity. At the same time that the conversation and the focus is not on the things that are most important to me. Right? So I am being drawn to bring diversity, to appeal to the folk who represent a diversity in order to support those who are already in the center. Right? And that is true whether it is my queer community asking this black queer to show up, as it is my black community asking this queer person to show up. Right? And I think that, and certainly it's also true of those affirming spiritual or religious spaces that would like this black queer to show up. Right? And I'm saying, well, that's great, but that asking me to come and having me there is not the end of your broadening of the tent movement. Right? So, and I think that this is part of the challenge of why things are so challenging on the left. And this is just a contribution. I won't say that this is a primary thesis I've been working on forever. And that is that the left is having a hard time holding together because of the diversity that exists there. And I would say, I would agree with Robin that a large part of that is class related in terms of the wide diversity of resources the wide diversity of the resources that exist there, and the inability to appeal to the inability to appeal to the idea of a singular idea of prosperity and belonging. Because I think that the folk on the left, there's a lot of diversities there. I just came back, if you would permit me just a couple of minutes to say, I just came back from Calgary. I'm part of an organization that does some lobbying at various times of the year, and going to the Stampede is actually one of the most important political networking and lobbying events on the annual calendar in Canada. But every time I go there, I pass through a looking glass because I'm going to be talking to people about issues like social justice and the like, where the language of that is not almost non-existent. And I was at a breakfast. It was a public thing, so I'll say it this way. I was at the federal conservative breakfast that was being hosted by a turban-wearing, traditional beard-wearing brown person.
Sikh, come on. Sikh.
Who got to introduce his colleagues in the party, including the main speaker, who was Pierre Poilievre. And in a large community event, you know, a large parking lot where there are hundreds of people assembled, I was looking around, and one of the things that was being said by the person who was introducing the event, the bouncy castle is over there, the petting zoo is over there, and oh, by the way, we have a tent over here where we are providing settlement services. So if you need any assistance with settlement services related to immigration, you can go to the tent over there. And maybe 50% of the people in the audience were white, and the rest of the folk were representing different racial identities. And Poilievre begins to give his Trump speech about rugged individualism and conservative and Canadian values and, you know, family and hard work and, oh yes, and we need to address immigration and we need to you know, keep people coming here who are clogging up our healthcare system and he stammered as he spoke. Because as he looked over the crowd, I'm sure he saw, you know, you were just introduced by a brown man who is a member of your party and a recent immigrant. And yet this rhetoric is still your rhetoric. And the thing that I found most disturbing was that the brown people there cheered as loudly as the white people because they were wanting to affiliate with being at the center. As if we can close the door now that I'm here. You know? Not realizing that should that movement be successful, yes, they would be inside the tent, but it wouldn't be long before there was a purging within the tent. and that people don't have the vision to see that. And I think that that the simplicity of the rhetoric on the right allows there to be this kind of unity, whereas the complexity of the dynamic on the left makes it hard for us to have some unity.
What a throw.
Even though the simplicity over here makes absolutely no sense. Anyway, I just, that recent event has just come to my mind, and I wanted to push back to be clear that the responsibility for this broadening of the tent is on those who are at the center and have the resources, not on those who are experiencing marginality, even within our queer community.
Thank you for that, Robert. I think you're still muted, Robin.
Yeah, Robert, Chris makes a very good point, and it's just reminding me of one of the texts I keep going back to, and I wish it was in more general circulation. It's Bernice Johnson Reagan, who probably is a name that both Vida and Robert may know. She was one of the chief members and songwriters for Sweet Honey in the Rock, which was the black activist women's a cappella group that partly inspired For the Moment, and they actually sang some of Sweet Honey's music. But Bernice Johnson Reagan wrote a piece in 1982. Well, what she actually gave a talk, which was then written down and published in an anthology of black women's writing. And it was at not the Michigan Women's Music Festival. I think it was at the Yellowstone Music Women's Festival. But she talked about the space of coalition. She said, "I'm here, and for me, I'm here in the space of coalition. This is not a comfortable space. This is like I'm being surrounded by people who are saying, 'Oh, here we are. It's our comfortable space.' But it's the comfortable space for white middle-class lesbians." And I am here. I've chosen to be here, Bernice is saying. But there's also, there's also the pleasure of going back to a space that isn't this space, a space that actually is where there are more people like me. And I feel more centered in that space. It's important to be in that space, but it's like you have to go into your uncomfortable space of coalition to create that space. You can't just call on me to come into it and to be in that space of discomfort and of friction that's inevitably there. You have to be aware of your privilege in this space and of the discomfort you have to put yourself through to create and to put yourself into the space of coalition.
I think this conversation really gets into what really our next questions are going to be is like tactics and strategies for, like, we've established that working in coalition is what needs to be done, and that it is those who are at their most comfortable who need to reckon with their comfort. But I still, I'm sitting here in my comfort and wondering what that looks like, I guess, is where I am. And so I don't know if we want to talk more on this, or we do have some time to open the floor to questions from our participants, our attendees.
May I respond?
Yeah, of course.
And it's probably not going to be popular. So I'll add that to the top. So the Women Next Door have been a force. We don't charge. We've been at Take Back the Night, December 6th, IWD, AIDS vigils, trans vigils. We just show up. For 32 years, we've shown up. And it's very funny. When I talk about the cohesiveness of the queer community, this is like kind of going to that. So we have gone to Unison festivals for years. They've wanted us to do host it for years. And we're all older. Like, I'm the youngest of the women at 58. So we, at the last one, we put in a bid and we won. And so we brought all these really fantabulous queer choirs to Halifax. And my challenge is how we are as a community, how we support through men's and they, them, and women's and she, they, like how we support one another. So we won that bid. The Halifax Gay Men's Choir, and this may be not popular, so I apologize. The Halifax Gay Men's Choir started because there was this big event coming, which we were so excited about, and still am so excited about, because it just highlighted the talent and the commitment to the community in this area. Like, it was all that in a bag of chips, for sure. So we did that. We planned. There's 12 of us. There's 60, 70 of them. And, you know, when they do a performance, it's like $25 to $50 to get in. When we do a lot of our performances, it's because we show up, and there's no remuneration. It's just because we show up, and we do our thing, and we support one another. And I think there's a divide within the queer community around how we see the work that's done between the women's community and the men's community. And, you know, the unpopular opinion that I'm going to express, and I'm not saying that everyone feels this way, I just feel quite strongly about it, is that with the Women Next Door in particular, it's not auditioned. It's affinity group. It's by consensus. It's, you know, your ability to participate in things are not class, and I think this comes from the whole class conversation, is not class oriented. Whatever it is that needs to happen for you to be a part of something that we're doing, class, money is not a part of it. We each ebb and flow with whatever is needed. And honestly, that is the first, that's the first group I've ever been a part of where money is not the you can be a part of this or you can't be a part of this scenario. And it's taught, I mean, I already had those roots, but it's taught me so much about who's included and who's not included, who gets to have a say and who doesn't get to have a say. So when I say the Halifax Gay Men's Choir, they have so much to offer. And I saw within our community this idea around more than, less than. So the Halifax Chamber of Commerce was giving an award around bringing business to Halifax. And they honored the Halifax Gay Men's Choir for bringing unison to the city. And the leader of that, and I'm sure I'm going to get backlash, the leader of that invited, we don't have a leader, but the person who was probably more in tune with taking those leadership roles was invited to be part of the dinner where he would get an award. So in my mind, why does the gay community think that taking credit where they weren't even a part of it is okay? And the other is how insulting it is, one, to be a part of you getting that award when you had nothing to do with it. And this is, you know, people don't talk about the diversity within the queer community, but there is diversity. There is inequities within the queer community that, you know, because women tend to not be the ones at the panel who are not the ones who speak the most, who are not the ones who have the most sway. But who, in the essence of being women, and in the essence of being so committed to the queer community, do what needs to be done in the background because it needs to be done. You know, I don't think that enough acknowledgement is... This is my tirade. I'm so sorry. Not enough acknowledgement is given to the women who stand up, who do the things, who sacrifice, who show up, who do the work. Like, I was a part of the very end of the Unison Festival, and there are 60, 70 people in the Helvex Gay Men's Choir, and I mean to call them out. Like, I am not opposed to calling them out, but here's the thing. We had to pack up tables, chairs, stereo equipment, all that. And there were four men who showed up to help us with that. Because the feedback that you would get for doing a good job was gone. You know, you can't be seen for doing a good job because you're doing all the behind-the-scenes stuff. And I think that I would challenge that in the men's community, doing the behind-scenes shit counts for a lot. And just showing up for the things that get the soundbite, the things that get you on a whatever, you know, it puts the women's community who have been there from time immemorial, working their ass off to do the shit, as a less than. And I think that is an inequity that is not challenged enough within the queer community. And I don't know why, and maybe I'm wrong. Like, I will take feedback that I am way off base. Like, that I am saying something that is absolutely dishonoring the contribution that gay men make. I just say, to me, that stuck in my craw is stuck in my craw 24 hours later, is stuck in my craw 6 months later, it's stuck in my craw a year later.
Where's my phone?
And when people ask me, there's the gay men's choir. Yes, oh my God, they're amazing. Like, they're amazing. They're amazing. I would not take away the absolutely amazingness of that choir, but I also think there's no one challenging. And part of me is, like, upset with the women's community. Well, that's just how it is. Well, fuck that. Like, I do not believe... My sister has a It Is What It Is, and I have a t-shirt that says It Is What We Think It Is. So my challenge would be that we need to do better as a community. We need to acknowledge the people who are contributing, who are showing up.
Yeah.
I'm sure I've, you know, I thought long and hard about sharing that, but I'm sure it'll be done.
Dina, before Robin says anything, I just want to say, I think this is exactly the kind of thing that needs to be discussed at a Rad Pride conversation. And so, you know, I'll say more after Robin speaks, but I just want to affirm you speaking.
Mm. Thank you.
My phone's supposed to be making.
Before we go on, I do want to say we have about 10 minutes left. I don't want to cut anything off. I don't want to cut any, like, great conversation off and people getting into nitty gritty of, like, how to organize across difference and how to have a, like, radical solidarity where, like, you know, we're all queer, but we are all our own people. I want to make sure we have this conversation. I also, if anybody, any participants have any questions, if you want to pop them in the chat, we can try to get to that. but I just don't want to cut anything off with the time constraints that we have. Thanks.
I'm willing to stay later.
I want to say, first of all, just to yes to what Robert said, this is exactly, we need to, these things need to be brought out. They need to be talked about. That's the only way that we make the coalition is by being honest and being clear about where the frictions are, where the disjunctures are. And I mean, there's a lot of things I think in Vita and what you've said. I won't try to address them all, but one of them, of course, is women's work. And you know, I think it's 22 Minutes has a skit that where about the magic coffee table where this guy says, oh, you know, like I leave my dirty dishes on this coffee table and then I come back and they're all done. He doesn't know that the woman he's living with is washing them off. and I'm very aware of women's work, which is a pattern that both men and women can take too much for granted, you know, in terms of women not challenging it and men not stepping up to do their part in it. But I think there's also an issue which gender comes into it, but also it has to do with progressive organizations and how and what we do for free and what we ask people to do for free. And it can become an issue in that also in racial terms and indigenous terms, a lot of times people in marginalized communities are asked to do things for free, to provide expertise, to provide some kind of credibility by their presence. I'm aware as a cultural worker, this panel, one of the things I asked in our early emails is there any payment for being on the panel? And it's not, because I mean, I make my living as a writer and an historian, and, I have enough, fortunately now I have the privilege of having a small pension, enough to keep a roof over my head and food on the table, but anything extra, like traveling, is going to come from being paid for the work I do. Now, I also have a policy, I never say no to things that are community organizations, and I believe in access. I don't want to, that people can't access, for example, what I have to say because of money. But the question I usually ask is, do you have a budget? You know, and if so, where does the budget come from? Do you have a grant? You know, and where does the money come from? Comes from is important because, as we know from the problems around Pride, the money coming from corporations is an issue. We were really lucky with, I was not so lucky with hard work as well, but when we had the Turret and the Gay Alliance for Equality, we ran a social space that had a modest charge that made money off of alcohol, that we said there's some problems with that, being a big space. But basically it was community money, and that community money employed community people. And, we didn't require money from the government or from corporations. The money came from within the community and it went back to the community and it funded a whole range of services for the community. But I think sometimes that, we need to ask ourselves, is there maybe money? And maybe we don't want to get it from TD Bank, but maybe we get it from a cultural funding organization or, you know, there may, you know, I wish sometimes that people in progressive movements could ask themselves, might there be some money to help people? So, for example, whether it's with travel costs for people to come, because there is also the question of who can afford to show up? To provide the free, you know, service, the free public good. If there's no money for transportation, particularly for people coming a long way or who are disabled, if, you know, for the time, many people just can't, you know, they need that time to make money to feed their children. So I think we could ask ourselves more often, is there a way of generating income in an acceptable way from an acceptable source that can then go to those who need it? So I don't think it's an either or, but it's a complex question, one where as soon as you get into money, especially looking at the sources of it, there are all kinds of complexities arise. But I do think we need to value people's work, and as long as we live in a money economy, people do need money to put food on the table and to move their bodies around in space. And we need, in any progressive organization, I think we need to ask ourselves if what we can do to address that.
Thank you, Robin. I know with the work that I do is like similar to what Vito was saying, just like you do it, you show up, people try to show up, maybe they have like their kids in tow or you have to meet online so that people don't have to drive to meet you or whatever other reasons. And I'm very happy to be able to have gotten the community support that we did for Rad Pride, from Radstorm, from Waves. And that, you know, we aren't just like screw corporate pride, but also we do have corporate sponsors, like that we were able to get that. I hope we got that right. Where we only have about 5 minutes left, I want to open the floor. I know Dan had a question about right at this moment today, July 2025, what is our greatest challenge and what should we be focusing on? But I think that was answered. We need coalition. We need to organize. We need to, meaningfully make the tent bigger. When we make that tent bigger, whoever's standing at the edge of it, make sure that they're not still caught out in the rain.
I think of something that Joy DeGruy says. Joy DeGruy is a social worker, academic writer who wrote the book on post-traumatic slave syndrome, which is talking really about the intergenerational trauma of black people in North America. And she says, you know, white privilege is simply an artifact of history. And having white privilege does not send you to heaven or hell. It's what you do with your privilege that determines whether you go to heaven or hell. And I think that that's true for everyone. I am a black, queer, educated, professional class individual who has recently taken on a tenure track position at a university. I'm a black queer of privilege.
Yeah.
I agree with Robin that, you know, questions around money and all of it, but for me, my Afrocentricity and my queer spiritual liberation ideology requires me to be thoughtful about those who are my siblings who have less than me. It is a requirement. And it's also a requirement for me that I am not being primarily motivated by the preservation of the to preserve the privilege that I have been able to attain, right? Which means that if I am from my queer black location choosing not to advocate for the queer and black community because it may disrupt my privilege, I have just purchased a ticket to hell.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Definitely.
And that is why I think that it's important for us to bring this, and it's a class and a privilege and a power conversation into the queer conversation, because we know that our community is stratified. Right? And that there needs to be some acknowledgement of that. So in an American university where the men's football team gets the lion's share of the money, there must be some mechanism whereby the money is redistributed to those other spaces that do not get that money. And how do we model that in our queer community Because the fact that we're a marginal community does not make us immune from, or it doesn't remove from us the obligation to redistribute resources within our community. Right? In the same way that in the black community we have an obligation to do that, because the black civil rights movement was a movement that did not touch the class problem. In fact, when you think about it, if the idea around the black liberation movement was that, you know, housing segregation had to be eliminated and we won that fight, well, who are the black people who got to live in white communities? The black people who could afford to live in white communities. The black people who couldn't afford to live in white communities were still segregated. So the class piece didn't get addressed, and we run the risk of something similar. So in building that big tent has to be a tent that not only tries to diversify in terms of the class, but also tries to level the resources, the opportunities that exist within the tent. And that I think, has to be a part of our movement. It's a communist idea. And I'm okay with that.
I want to say something about the word privilege, because I sometimes like to say that instead of thinking of us having privilege, I prefer to say that privilege has us. Mm-hmm. That privilege is a structure that we're all implicated in. We're all located somewhere in that structure, and we've been located there by history. That doesn't and so the response, correct response to that isn't guilt or shame. The correct response is to take responsibility for understanding where you are and how you got there. And the other thing that I want to stress, and maybe this is me as someone who liberated himself from Christianity at the age of 9, is that I want to be wary of the "you ought to," "we are obliged to," "we should," because there's often our rhetoric is around moral obligation, and that you're a bad person if you don't do this. But it implies that's like working to dismantle the structure of privilege is going to hurt. Well, it will hurt. It will, you know, losing privilege hurts. But I want to do it because I think I will be happier when the structures of privilege are taken apart. And I think ultimately, if someone's working with us who doesn't really believe they're going to be happier with structures of privilege dismantled, then I don't want them working with, because they're not actually motivated to make the revolutionary change. And this goes to the question of the imagination, which I think is, I've been thinking a lot about recently, that, and where the gap is in terms of having, you know, not that I want us to have one big unified picture, because of course we want, you know, the picture to be nuanced and open to lots of variation, but we need to have enough of the common image, enough of the common picture, that we can say, wouldn't it be nice, wouldn't it be beautiful to live in this world, imagine a world, you know, where there was no substantial economic inequality, where everybody really did have equal access and opportunity, and where love rather than power was the dominant force in human relations. I think one part of the challenge is that, and why we're facing the reaction we're facing, is because people are fighting to defend their way of seeing the world. Because more than anything else, it comes down to patriarchy, because that's the force that is runs through all of the reactionary forces in the world today, the defense of male supremacy, and the way of seeing the world now in a binary view again, but also binary view in terms of the world being a bunch of objects that we control and own, as opposed to being our relations. You know, like those trees that we're thinking of chopping down and making to paper, that I'm related to that. We have a common ancestor. And that doesn't mean we might not chop down a tree, but when we chop it down, we thank the tree, because the tree is related to us. We are actually distantly related. There is somewhere back there a single-celled organism that we're both descended from. Indigenous worldviews often give us examples of other ways of being in the world. But we're so immersed in our way of being in the world and that's been challenged. It's because there's been a partial, not fully successful revolution culturally. That this happened in Germany before the Nazis, and it happened in many Western countries in the 1960s, where a lot of things got thrown into question and a lot of space was claimed, sometimes successfully, but the basic ways of things operating and the basic ways of looking at the world and talking about it did not change. And so it's like, this isn't, you know, the people who are defending the way things are or have been, that want to make America great again, are not going to listen to reason. They're fighting against what they're seeing as the loss of their world, because the world in their head is not the world that exists. It's not the world that could exist. But we have to find a way to put forward an image of the world that enough of our fellow human beings are going to say, yes, you know what? That's an image that means something to me. I'm prepared to let go of some of these ways of thinking and to let go of some of the privilege that holds us, because it's a trap. Privilege is a trap for us. To realize that I want to get out of that trap, to be in this other structure that isn't structured around privilege, but that is actually a much better place to be living as a human being.
I have a question.
Yes.
How do you know someone is not influenced by privilege?
Well, no, I didn't say someone's not influenced, but everyone's influenced by privilege. Privilege, you know, where you are affects what you see, and it's a constant life struggle to become aware of the ways in which you're shaped by your circumstances of birth. It's that, like, if I fundamentally believe that patriarchy, I would be better in patriarchy because men are better off, but I ought to share my power with women, I don't think that makes me an ally. I think I would like to see patriarchy destroyed because I think I will be happier.
Gotcha.
Just as a white person would say, I would like to see racism destroyed because I believe I would live freer in a world that is not racist.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that the challenge in all of that is that in a society that has allowed such rampant accumulation of wealth and resources, that can only be achieved through the redistribution of those resources or the imagining of those resources as commonwealth resources, right? And that will require a letting go.
Well, it also requires a redefining of wealth is, because our society is wealthy. But how come first of all, I remember 50 years ago, we could afford more culture and education and health than we can afford now.
Yes.
Why is that? There's more money. And our trees are dying, and the animals are dying, and the air is becoming unbreathable. Like we're not wealthier. We're becoming poorer and poorer and poorer. There's more and more money, but there's less air and food and water. So part of it is that we have to, like I say, it's because our wealth has been defined around power, and the nature of that is that it can't be spread evenly. Whereas if we define our wealth as access to culture, access to nature, to health, to loving human relations, the more that's available to some people, the more that should be available to other people. It's not a finite pie; it can be grown for everyone.
John.
And how do you see that happening?
My apologies, folks, but I am
yeah, we're
pull off screen in a little bit here.
Like really dynamic conversations happening, which honestly are moving into what I'm hoping our next panel will be about, which is the complicity and the entanglement of corporations and pride and these corporations that are also funding imperialism around the world, and how that ties in with capitalism and colonialism and all of her favorite isms. Next Wednesday, on Zoom, 6:30, we will be speaking with a number of panelists still working on getting them all together, and we'll be talking about how all systems of oppression are interconnected. Also, how corporate pride fails us by getting in bed with all of those corporations that are, you know, not actually going to liberate us ever. And how we can really only do that for ourselves.
Can I ask that Viva's question, how do we see us getting there, should be a place to start for a future conversation.
Yes.
And also,
yes.
I'd just like to ask about how word has gone out. This is the, and maybe I just haven't, I probably should have been looking, probably been in waves, and I haven't picked it up from there, but like, how are, like, I didn't know about next Wednesday, and, and I know you advertise a lot on Instagram. I don't do Instagram. It's a matter of
fact. Me neither. Yeah, we only just started, like, so we started actually posting on our Instagram about a week ago. We put up some posters around the city over the weekend, and a little bit has gone through just, like, social connections.
But that's selective, and that's a form of privilege. need to address, Brad Pryor needs to talk about how does the word get out?
Yeah.
And how many ways could you get the word out?
Yeah, and that's part of why we wanted to just do straight postering, so that we could get kind of like whoever is walking down the street.
I live in Sheet Harbor. I don't think you're postering Sheet Harbor.
Yeah, no, we're definitely not.
I might be able to post to Sheet Harbor, but you have to send me the poster.
Yeah,
if you send me the poster, I will get it out to the choir and the Women Next Door and all the other gay queer groups that I'm a part of.
Yep, I will. I will try to make my poster more than 4 days in advance this time.
No, you're doing you're doing your thing. I appreciate it.
I'm trying. I'm learning a lot. So I will email all of you the poster when it is done. I will email everybody on this list the poster when it is done if they wish. And I will, it'll be on Instagram. I can probably, actually, if anybody's Facebook user and I just send it to them, feel free to redistribute there. And through your social channel, or like through your actual social channels, not like just the internet. We'll see if we can get a little bit of a wider range of people than whoever happened to see it in the last 3 days. Which awesome. Thank you all for coming. I'm honestly surprised I managed to get the people that I did get to show up with the sort of like harebrained, half-assed way that I've done this so far. But we'll only get better. We're going to do these all year, I hope. So because we're queer all year, we're always here. We're not going anywhere. Thank you all so much. I think we need to call it.
Yeah.
Thanks for sitting here for almost 2.5 hours with all of us. This was really incredible. And, thank you. Thank you to the panelists. Thank you to those who came to listen and to contribute. And I hope to see you all again.
Love you all.
Also, if you have 2 seconds, I would like to talk to you.
Oh, to me?
Sure. Nate, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Ciao.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, turn off that recording.
What are you doing, beast? You're so frisky.